It's time now for Oh the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship research and events on campus. A lot of them online now. We'll be talking about one that's coming up in just a couple of days. We've got a very special guest on the phone who's going to be joining us in a minute, who we'll introduce. But we are joined in the studio right now by Lloyd Kramer, heads up Carolina Public Humanities. Humanities.unc.edu is the website for more information about what's going on. Lloyd, thank you so much for being with us. How are you?
Thank you very much, Aaron. It's good to be here. Yeah. I'm fine.
That's good. Making it through. We were talking right before we started that there's just an incredible amount of uncertainty in the world right now. And even now today that we're seeming to come out on the other side of the uncertainty and getting a little bit clearer picture, at least of where the election stands, we're still in the middle of a lot of ambiguity.
We are, and one of the great things about the humanities is that they help us to deal with what is unknown and to understand that it's part of the human condition. So we're right in action
right
here
there,
at the Carolina
yeah.
Public Humanities.
Well, we are. I'm excited about what we're going to be talking about here in the next few minutes, because coming up this Thursday, again, you can head to humanities.unc.edu for a lot of information about a bunch of upcoming events. One of them is coming up on Thursday at 5 o'clock. It's a talk. It's going to be online. It's a talk called Ordinary Men Revisited. And the title refers to the seminal work Ordinary Men, which was written back in the 90s by Christopher Browning, who is now an emeritus professor of history at UNC. This will be a talk on Thursday in which Professor Browning looks back at the book and revisits its findings and the discussion that arose around it. That's going to be on Thursday. Again, more information on the website humanities.unc.edu, and Christopher Browning joins us on the phone to talk about it. Professor Browning, thank you so much for being with us today. How are you?
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
So give us a rundown of the talk that's going to happen on Thursday. What will it entail?
Basically, it will be in three parts. I'll talk a little bit about how the book was written, how I came to the topic, and put the book together. And then second, I will be looking at the various criticisms that were aimed at the book and the debate that it stirred in the 1990s. And then thirdly, I'll look at several of the more recent developments that have occurred since the turn of the century, and where, in a sense, perpetrator studies within the wider framework of Holocaust studies is going at the moment.
And this is for people who don't know, this is a seminal book about, again, in Holocaust studies, but about the people in Germany and in Europe who perpetrated the Holocaust, and just trying to get a sense of who these people were and what motivated them. And this was a book when it was released that stirred, as you mentioned, a lot of conversation and discussion and criticism, and other books that came out to add their voices to the conversation too. Now we're almost 30 years since the book was published. How have you thought differently, and how do you think the same today versus when you first published it?
Well, certainly I think the two sort of fundamental issues around which the book pivoted, I think still hold. Namely, that I was able to find a case study, a single killing unit, mm-hmm. Reserve Police Battalion 101, that was comprised of what I call ordinary men. These were middle-aged conscripts, too old for the German army, but had to do military service, that were thrown together and sent to Poland with virtually no training, no indoctrination, no selectivity, not anything more Nazified than the general German population, and become one of the most lethal killing units in the German occupation regime in Eastern Europe. And what it made even more frightening was this was a unit where not only could courageous individuals who tested the system opt out, but the commanding officer made it explicit that no one had to kill who didn't want to. And so it was a public open offer that no officer could coerce any of the men to shoot, because the major had made clear that those that weren't up to it could opt out and not take part in the killing process. So it was a case study that brought together both the issue of not what in Germany is referred to as the excess perpetrators, the people that tortured and took gratuitous glee over inflicting suffering, but actually average, randomly selected people off the street and given a choice not to participate, nonetheless kill. And that, in a sense, opens up the whole issue of wider issue of motivation. These aren't crazed, fanatical Nazis. These are, in a sense, example of a regime's capacity to harness ordinary people to become genocidal killers. Mm-hmm. The core of the book, I think, is still very much there, and why the book continues now, now close to 30 years later, still to be used in classrooms and still sells very well. So it is, in that sense, has remained relevant. What has happened since is that a lot of other killer units of this kind are now being studied. So we have much more comparative work. This was, in effect, sort of the first case study of a small killing unit that we had information about more than just the officers. We knew could find out something about the rank and file. Now many other units have been studied, so we have a much broader comparative base to work from. And, of course, we also have done much more work in the collaborators, the non-Germans mm-hmm. who were recruited in Eastern Europe to form a major manpower component of the killing process. And our focus on motivation has shifted much wider than anti-Semitism. The question we used to ask, was anti-Semitism the driving motivation or something else? And now I think we've taken a much less binary approach. It's not anti-Semitism or it's how do we understand the varieties of anti-Semitism in Germany, how it connected with and is intertwined with many other feelings that had broad resonance in German society that the Nazis could co-opt and use to harharness people. The book, in a sense, did what any historian hopes their book will do. It both started a discussion and set off a research agenda that has advanced us and helped us to both pose and answer questions that we didn't even think about earlier.
Thank you. Chris, this is Lloyd Kramer. It's good to hear from you again. Your longtime colleague.
Hi, Lloyd.
Thank you for joining us. And I should mention to our audience that this is part of the Ullman Family Distinguished Scholar Lecture Series. So it is co-sponsored with the Center for Jewish Studies at UNC, and we appreciate their collaboration on this. I wanted to follow up on Aaron's question by just asking further, has anything come out in recent years that changes the way people understand motivations as in terms of group pressure or ideology or pressure from commanders? Has something changed from when you wrote your book?
I think we've accepted the complexity more. Mm-hmm. People wanted a single issue answers, wanted bullet points that would make the inexplicable more explicable. And I think we've learned to live with the complexity of it, that every individual, of course, makes his or her own decision, put them in a group, and you have an even more, a mix and match of different motives. So we're trying to find both what are kind of the broader generalizations we can make, with at the same time respecting the fact that we're talking about a whole series of individuals, none of whom is identical, but nonetheless are a product of the same culture, find themselves in the same situation, and therefore we can at least make generalizations that also respect the human agency of each of the individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking with Christopher Browning on the phone, Lloyd Kramer here in the studio as well, humanities.unc.edu for more information on Carolina Public Humanities and about Professor Browning's talk, which is going to be called Ordinary Men Revisited this Thursday, 5 to 6:30, again, presented in conjunction with the Center for Jewish Studies. So you have also written pretty extensively on present-day American politics, and you've written some stuff about the 2020 election, both before Election Day and now in the aftermath of it, that we have a better sense of how the election shook out. What are your thoughts about the election and the way that it developed? And you know, your book really added to our understanding about human beings and what motivates us to act in obviously extreme circumstances, but it's shown a light that we didn't have before. How does that research inform your thoughts about what's going on in America today?
Yeah, in a sense, the first question that I wrestled with is certainly after 2016, when many people made kind of facile comparisons between what was happening in the United States and Trump and Trumpism on the one hand, and Nazism, Hitler, and so forth on the other, that I thought that was a misled kind of simple comparison. Mm. And that I looked at what was taking place in the United States as a kind of rise of illiberalism, not a rise of fascism. That fascism was marked above all by a totalitarian dictatorship, war for vast conquest, and genocide. Thank goodness, none of that has been central to what's happened in the last 4 years. But that what we've seen instead is a retreat into, and in this sense, the United States is part of a much wider trend in the world, what Viktor Orban, one of the practitioners of it, himself coined as illiberalism. Mm-hmm. Preserving the facade of constitutional government and elections at the same time as managing them, tilting the playing field, so to speak, to make sure that the government really is not accountable to the people. It is the government that manages the people, not the people that vote and determine the government, that the rules are not what bind the government, but the government exploits and distorts rules to keep themselves in power without serious challenge. So the issue I wrestled with between 2016 and 2020 was to try to get away from a simplistic comparison with what happened in Europe in the 1930s, but nonetheless to say there was a threat to democracy, that democracy was not so much being overthrown as being suffocated slowly, and that it was a serious problem, one that could be met best by understanding in its own right, not by simply thinking it was a cookie-cutter version of National Socialism or Fascism. You had to know what it was you were dealing with precisely and accurately if you were going to deal with it effectively. Mm-hmm. With the election this fall, and indeed now that we know the results, I guess my feeling in after the election, certainly one was of relief, but not jubilation. Mm-hmm. Relief in the sense that we won't have 4 more years of what we have had in the last 4 years, but some apprehension in the sense that it is clear just how deep the polarization of American society runs, how we are two political tribes, two communities that are not living side by side very well, and that we have very different visions of where we should be going, and that negotiating the next few years and trying to detoxify the political world, the political life, is going to be a very, very challenging and very difficult task.
Thank you, Chris. I wondered if you could carry this to a somewhat even broader framework. To what extent do you think historical knowledge and parallels are useful for helping people understand current events? And to what extent do you think historical parallels can be deceptive or misleading?
Yeah, I think they become deceptive or misleading when we try to appropriate history simplistically and to capture or harness it for a political agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think that was happening with the Trumpism, Nazism parallel. Nothing so stigmatizes your opposition than be able to say they're like Hitler. That is kind of the Trump card, sorry for the pun, that one plays if you want to cast the whole conflict in terms of absolute right versus absolute wrong, or paradigmatic evil. So I think history, one, should teach us complexity and teach us how to live with complexity. And that to do that, we have to know enough to know we must not, in a sense, loot history for simple lessons appropriated for political agendas, but rather to have a deeper understanding of what we're dealing with, so we deal with it accurately, that we're not Don Quixote out jousting white windmills, but we're actually engaging with real problems and not imaginary ones. So I think that, in a sense, history both offers the temptation of misuse, but also offers the perspective and the tools for a much more insightful and productive understanding of where we are, where we came from, how we got here, and then hence a more accurate assessment of what our options are and what kinds of choices we have to make.
The talk is Ordinary Men Revisited. It is being put on by Carolina Public Humanities in conjunction with the Center for Jewish Studies, humanities.unc.edu. For more on that talk, you can sign up for it there. It's going to be this Thursday from 5 to 6:30. Lloyd Kramer, final thoughts, other things coming up that folks ought to know about?
I think this is the main thing I want to talk about today, and I want to thank Chris for joining us and coming back to Chapel Hill to be part of this event. And I particularly appreciate the subtlety and insights that he brings to every historical problem. He is the humanities in action at its best. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.